I'm Matthew Petty and this is Intersection. Responding to a domestic violence call is the most dangerous call a law enforcement officer can get. We're going to hear about one Central Florida Sheriff's Office that's teamed up with researchers at UCF to look out for signs of domestic violence and change the approach of first responders to those calls. And a warning for our listeners, the subject material may not be suitable for younger listeners. First though, as 90.7's Brendan Byrne reports, a deadly domestic violence incident last month where the suspect killed four children and himself and critically wounded a police officer highlights the danger these calls pose to law enforcement officers.
911 emergency, this is Jamie, recorded line.
Hi, Jamie. Officer Kevin Valencia, 27 years old, was responding to a domestic violence call at an Orlando apartment complex.
Okay, how many shots are you hearing?
We heard a bunch, I don't know, and the cop is down in the grassy area trying to get to the other. The cop is hurt.
Okay, the cop's down. Okay, are you near the cop?
After officers arrived, 3 to 4 shots were fired, and at least one of those shots hit Valencia, critically wounding him.
There's 3 of them down there working. They have the guy on the floor.
Okay, what's your name, sweetie? What's your name?
He was in a coma, but is now recovering at a specialized treatment facility in Georgia. Responding to a domestic violence call is the most dangerous call an officer can get. And that's no surprise to law enforcement, says Orlando Police Sergeant Eric Gopelbecker.
In the academy, officers are taught that that's probably one of the deadliest type of calls you go to due to the violent nature of them. Usually you're going there because there's a problem and it couldn't be settled by themselves.
According to research from the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund, 22% of all officer deaths between 2010 and 2014 were in response to domestic dispute calls. That's 20 officers in 5 years. But that number is on the rise, says researcher Desiree Luongo.
2015, 2016 years, we had 18. So we almost matched 5 years' worth of fatalities in just 2 years.
The nature of the crime is why they become violent. Domestic relationships are about control, says UCF sociologist Amy Rechtenwald.
They're already feeling that they're losing control in some way. So say it's a partner has just told them they're leaving them or they have left. So they're already feeling some sort of sense of loss of control. And then a police officer arrives at the scene. Again, that control is being taken away.
Another reason these calls can be so volatile is in part due to Florida law. Whenever a police officer finds probable cause for arrest, the officer can arrest the suspect, even without consent from the victim. That's different from other crimes, such as theft, where a victim would be required to press charges. Sergeant Gopelbecker says domestic violence perpetrators know that law.
But in these cases, a lot of the times when they know the police show up, a lot of the times a suspect will know probably they're going to jail. So we could face more resistance or where they hide and wait.
How and where officers are being injured is also changing. National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund researcher Desiree Luongo says between 2010 and 2014, 75% of officers were killed inside the home or building where the incident occurred. But in the following 2 years, around 35% were shot outside.
So they're being killed as they arrive on scene, and they're being killed at a greater distance. And we're also seeing a rise in the use of rifles as opposed to handguns in these deaths as well.
The fund's research found that many fatalities were a result of officers going into an incident alone or not waiting for backup. That's something the Orlando Police Department and Gopelbecker take seriously.
Safety in numbers. So you always wait. You wait on your back. And a lot of the times if you see officers trying to go to them alone, then the sergeant usually has to kind of pull them aside, especially the new officers that are really gung-ho wanting to go out there and save the world, is you have to rein them in and just say no.
The Orlando Police Department created a domestic violence response team to provide training and resources to officers responding to these types of calls. There's at least one officer on each shift that's an expert in domestic violence cases. The goal? Get domestic violence victims the help they need and reduce the risk of officer injury and fatality. Brendan Byrne, 90.7 News.
And as 90.7's Brendan Byrne discovered in his reporting, the Brevard County Sheriff's Office is tackling domestic violence by focusing on the offender, not the victim. And they're also zeroing in on a specific offense, strangulation. We're joined now by Agent Cindy Young with the Brevard County Sheriff's Office. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start by playing a little bit of sound from an interview that our reporter Brendan Byrne did with UCF sociology professor Amy Rechtenwald. Now, Professor Rechtenwald says if a domestic violence victim is strangled, the chance of that victim being killed by their partner increases by more than 700%. Let's just take a listen.
And most people don't even realize that. But strangulation is really difficult to identify, and officers, they might be trained, like, hey, if they say they've been choked or strangled, record that. Look for signs of strangulation, and if you think of strangulation, you think of, like, bruising around your neck. But in reality, research shows that about 50% of cases don't show any kind of visible symptoms of strangulation. So if an officer goes to the scene of a domestic violence incident, looks at the victim doesn't say they were choked or strangled, doesn't look like they were choked or strangled, then that's it. Nothing's going to happen.
So that's UCF sociology professor Amy Richtenwald. Cindy Young, I know you've worked with Professor Richtenwald on sort of developing this program and training your deputies on what to look for. It sounds like some of those signs and symptoms might not be identifiable unless you know what you're looking for. Tell me about that.
Well, when we were doing the research on how we're going to address this issue, clearly, you know, obviously we need to do a little bit better job at documenting the evidence so we can hold these offenders accountable. So we studied it for almost a year. We had meetings to figure out what to do, and how we ended up segueing into it is realizing that we have to hit it from all angles. We had to hit it from the medical side. We have to educate the first responders. We need to get immediate medical assessment of the victim on the scene due to the dangers that are underestimated by all of us, really, at the time, because we just didn't know. It wasn't like anybody was turning the blind eye. It's just it takes time and identifying the issue in order to address it. So that's what we did. And so we said, hey, let's do a multidisciplinary approach to this. Let's go ahead and involve the health department, the fire rescue personnel. Let's educate the deputies. Let's partner with academia and bring in UCF and their sociology department to track the results and see if we can't make a difference in this. And that's what we've done. And I see that we've made a good impact over the last 3 years. I'm very pleased. The year before we even started looking into this, there was 2 documented domestic homicides by strangulation in our county alone, just in our county that year. I believe there was a third. The body was recovered out of our county, but they originated from our county. So it could be actually 3 domestic homicides within a 12-month period. Since we've done this, and I'm going to find the wood to knock on right now, we have hit it so hard with the education and the and really charging these offenders properly, we haven't had any in our county. I'll just say, let me qualify that with investigated by the sheriff's office, because we do have a lot of city jurisdictions.
Sure.
But they're not offering the same service, which is introducing a medical component. So we're offering medical exams through forensic nurse examiners for these strangulation victims, which offers us additional evidence, which then allows us to hold the offenders more accountable for their actions.
What was the genesis of this project? Like, what got you started on saying this is something we can focus on and here's how we can make a difference?
It was a national conversation. It started out of San Diego in California. There's a Center for Hope out there in San Diego, and they do a lot of domestic violence research. They started the strangulation research, and then they started putting it out through the domestic violence fatality review teams, which I was a member of for our county. So I was able to go out to Arizona and meet with some top professionals out there regarding this, how to address it. We brought it back here. I partnered with the Florida Coalition Against Domestic Violence, Vince Mazzara, who passed away, unfortunately, before he got to see this program going. But he was very instrumental in helping us get the training and setting the program up. And so our sheriff was very supportive of it. And that's how it kind of got started. It was a lot of work. It still is. But I think it's worth it all in the end.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you know about other law enforcement agencies in Florida working on this kind of program?
At this point, there is no other that I'm aware of that's offering the forensic nurse exams. Everybody is trying to address the issue because it has been, like I said, a national conversation, some more than others. Some have implemented some direct training to their first responders. Some have introduced a form for the first responders to use to kind of prompt to ask the right questions and document the evidence. But as far as actually hitting it in this at this magnitude and all the different multidisciplinary areas, we're the only ones doing it as far as I know. I would love to see the research support the program be spread throughout the entire state. I mean, there are other law enforcement agencies in the country that are doing it. Maricopa County out and out west, they're doing it, and have been doing it, but they haven't been tracking it with the research like we have through the University of Central Florida. And when we do that empirical data research, it allows us to be able to seek the funding, because that's the big question: is how much is this going to cost us? How much are we going to? How much can we afford to do? And right now, we've been privately funded so far. So we're hoping that, you know, with the research, that we'll be able to seek some assistance through through grants and federal programs.
How much does it cost? It's been running for 3 years, right?
It actually is relatively inexpensive, to believe it or not. I mean, it's not really. We got about $25,000 for the first startup from a private foundation, the Shirley E. Nolan Foundation, which they have been so supportive and so helpful with us getting this program going. But that money lasted us for a year and a half. Now, that's including. Everybody's kind of pitching in, though. I mean, we didn't charge for everything that we did. You know, our sheriff donated all the printing, and the health department was all very helpful with their admin side. But the exams themselves, we pay the nurse examiners $500. We pay them that to come out. They're on call 24 hours a day. They'll come at 3 in the morning if we need an exam. They document the medical evidence, and then they submit it to us, and we put it into evidence. They're also subject to testimony at trial. So that, to me, is a bargain. You know, $500 on a case that this victim could potentially end up dead if we don't do something with this offender, or if not her, then maybe somebody else down the line.
So just kind of walk me through what the project involves. You train up your officers on what to look for, and then if they see what they think is signs of strangulation, they'll make the call and say, we need to get a nurse examiner to come and check this out.
Exactly. Initially, we have them identify if there has been a strangulation event. If there's been a strangulation event, we also educate the dispatchers as well, because sometimes the officers are only going to know what the dispatchers tell them before they get there. So the dispatchers are trained to pick that out if the caller calls in and says, you know, yeah, and he choked me too, as a secondary. Because, you know, if you've got an arm broke, you're going to talk more about your arm being broke than something that, you know, you went unconscious slightly for a short amount of time and you don't really recognize that that, you know, is also an extremely dangerous event.
It's. I mean, just kind of stepping back for a minute, it's terrible to think that you have to kind of triage all these awful things that are happening as a victim. I mean, that must be tremendously hard to do.
And you can't as a victim. You're so. That's why it need. That's why we need to educate when people aren't in that traumatic event. We need to, you know, get this information out to everyone, and we've done that by including in our work group, not just the health department. We've reached out to the hospitals to supply information to them. We have, like I said, fire rescue, our fire rescue people in our county. We, all of the domestic violence shelters have got people on the work group. They disseminate information. We have civic groups that come and we give training to, they go out and talk to church groups and all these different venues that we're not typically going to be able to reach. So, yes, as a trauma victim, you're not going to be able to just say and understand everything. So that's why it's important that we educate, one, whenever you're not involved in the trauma, and two, the people that should know how to, you know, that are going to be responding to this, that's going to be able to document it. And also share the information. Also, the introduction of early victim advocacy is very important. And what we did is we changed our policy on strangulation cases that it mandates first responders to contact a victim advocate immediately while they're on scene with the victim on a strangulation event. We have 4 full-time advocates in our agency, and they rotate on call. You know, if they need to go out, they go out. They get in their car and they go out. If they can just talk to the person on the phone and or they're declining the exam and they can talk to them on the phone and set it up for the next day to see if there's any artifacts, medical artifacts to be documented, that's great. And they do that. And that, to me, is extremely important because it tells the victim you're not alone. You know, there's going to be somebody here, not just this deputy who's showing up and potentially just taking the person to jail or not. And then, you go back to your life and they go on to the next call. Mm-hmm. It tells the victim that, look, there's somebody going to be here for you. They're going to help you and they're going to direct you and they're going to give you the information you need in order to secure your own safety, because ultimately it's the decision of the victim on how they want to proceed. We evaluated this, how we were going to implement this program, for almost a year to make sure that we had addressed all these components. And that's why I think it is so successful, is because we didn't just take it and change our policy and say, okay, you guys are all going to respond in this way and that's what we're going to do. Instead, we partnered with our community and our different disciplines that were available to us to make sure that we hit it from all sides. And we're getting great results as far as I'm concerned. You know, you can't argue with the numbers.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to Agent Cindy Young with the Brevard County Sheriff's Office. I want to play a little bit more sound here. This is back to Professor Amy Richtenwald. Now, after about 4 years of researching and rolling out the project researching strangulation and domestic violence, Richtenwald says there has been some success. Let's just take a listen.
When you think of domestic violence, it's very, you might think, oh, well, why does this victim not want to prosecute, or why don't they want to testify and all these things? But it's very difficult to do that. And there are many reasons why a victim might stay in a relationship and not leave and not want her abuser to be arrested. And so if we can kind of cut them out of the picture and actually just have this evidence that we can use to prove that they've committed a felony, they've almost killed someone, then we can actually, you know, prevent these types of homicides.
So that's Professor Amy Richtenwald with the University of Central Florida. Agent Cindy Young, I mean, it sounds like it's really trying to shift the focus away from the victim and shift it on to the perpetrator, right?
Exactly. And a lot of programs are victim-based, but we are offender accountability-based.
Mm-hmm.
We have the component to take care of the victims and recognize that they need to be educated and things like that. And I'm not trying to minimize that part, because that's extremely important. But when you look at our focus, we're in law enforcement. We don't only have to worry about that victim, but we have to worry about any future potential victims. So we want to concentrate on that offender. And in this particular type of event, if we can compile enough evidence, then we have a better chance of the state going forward with the charges based on the evidence. If I'm saying I saw this, this, and this, and that's consistent, we have a medical professional saying I saw this, this, and this, and that's consistent, we have a dispatcher who's taking the call and asking the right questions, every time another layer is added, it's a less of a chance that the victim's going to have to testify, or we're going to have to rely on the victim for testimony in order to hold this person accountable. So that's another great thing about the domestic violence laws. And nationally, it's been very, very effective to do evidence-based prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
However, it can also be challenging if we don't have enough layers of independent testimony to support the charge, because then the state is then pretty much got their hands tied. They can't go forward in good faith if they don't have enough evidence to support the charge that's been presented. So then we're relying on the victim. The victim then feels like, you know, they're going to be in more danger because of it. And, you know, we're trying to remove that. And, this is a great way to do it, is just add another layer of testimony, another layer of evidence from the medical field.
And that's a good point, I think, to bring in another comment here from Amy Richtenwald, talking about how the prosecutor sort of plays into this piece. Let's just take a quick listen.
Initial kind of evaluation of the project does show that prosecutors are more likely to be able to file charges for strangulation and actually charge them with felony strangulation, which was really difficult before. Maybe half the cases were able to be filed by the prosecutor's office when they involved strangulation. They couldn't even file them because,
really?
You know, in order to prosecutors want to be able to convict. So if there's no evidence of a strangulation, they're not able to.
And that's from an interview with 90.7's Brendan Byrne. He's talking there to UCF sociology professor Amy Richtenwald, who's been researching the impact of strangulation, how that sort of fits into domestic violence and what law enforcement agencies can do to identify that and then take that further and take action on some of these cases. Agent Cindy Young with the Brevard County Sheriff's Office, where do you see this going from here? Do you have the resources that you need to train absolutely everybody you want to at this point? Are you going to be out there looking for more funding to do some more with this project?
Well, we are going to be looking for some more funding because we're, you know, coming to the end of our fiscal budget right now. But we are supported for the training through the Florida Coalition Against Domestic Violence. They have a real nice training budget. They'll bring the training to whomever asks for it. However, implementing this program is very labor intensive, and it can potentially get expensive to implement if you don't have the cooperation of everyone that kind of wants to kick in a little bit and say, yeah, let's do this. Mm-hmm. So what I would love to see is be able to, at the end of our research, be able to present a complete packet. If we get somebody come to us and say, listen, we need this in our community, could you show me how you did it? Then we can give them a packet that's portable, that they can just pick it up and take it and implement it in their agency. All of our growing pains that we've been going through for the last 3 or 4 years is also we can get this program out in other places. Mm-hmm. All of the speaking engagements that Dr. Rechtenwald and her department has done. She's graciously supplied interns to come over and gather the data and just to help us out tremendously with getting everything together. So honestly, we would love to see it implemented in other places because we're seeing an impact here. So just because you live, you know, in North Florida, don't you deserve the same service that the victims of strangulation are getting in Brevard County? Of course you do. Mm-hmm. So that's what I thought, and my administration agreed with whenever we heard about it in other states. Our victims here deserve that service. These offenders in our county need to be held accountable. And so that's what we would like to see, is just other people come and pick it up and be able to give them a package and say, listen, this is how we did it. Take it to your place, tweak it, make it work for you, and spread the program so we can make a real impact.
So talking about growing pains in the last few years, what are some of the big ones? What are some things that you wish you'd known before you started this project?
Oh, that list is long. I had no, as a law enforcement officer, a career law enforcement officer, I don't worry myself with how we're going to pay for things. Okay, I show up to work. I know I'm going to get a paycheck. You know, I know that if I need to do this or that, then I have the equipment and the tools and the training to do it.
Mm-hmm. But now you've got this project and you've seen it succeed in these last few years. Now you are worried about how do we keep this going,
yes,
right?
Yes. So and that's one of the hardest things for me is to figure out how to pay for this stuff. And like I said, we have been very blessed with the Shirley E. Nolan Foundation to be so supportive of our program, and they've really given us the chunk of money to really keep us going. They even refunded us last year so we could finish up the research. So at this point, you know, that's probably the hardest thing. Also maneuvering through who, getting the buy-in from everybody, how's the best way to do a mass education. Again, we're still expanding and thinking of ways that we can do it. It's ever evolving. So like I said, I'm hoping by the time that Dr. Rechtenwald has finished all the research and gotten everything together, then we'll be able to say, okay, I think we've addressed most of the issues that you, if you want to put this in your county or your state or your city, you know, here's the things that we encountered and here's how we overcame them. There was not a lot of resistance at all from anybody in our community. Everybody said, oh my gosh, why haven't we always been doing this? Even our chief is like, well, yeah, go look into this. The problem is that we weren't doing it before. Mm-hmm. So everybody is on board with holding offenders accountable, I think. Everybody wants to see victims of domestic violence escape that abuse and be able to survive. Nobody wants to see anybody die, you know, and we certainly don't want to take that responsibility because we decided not to do anything about it.
Well, Cindy Young is an agent with the Brevard County Sheriff's Office. Cindy, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Still to come on Intersection, what keeps a hospital busy in summer and why Orlando has a unique mix of patients through the doors of the ER.
The emergency department's a window into humanity, so every day, every shift, there's something that always kind of makes your eyes like, wow, look at that.
Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Emergency rooms are busy places, especially in summer, as more people are outside playing sports or enjoying the outdoors, and sometimes they get injured. Dr. Christopher Hunter is the Assistant Program Director of the Orlando Health Emergency Medicine Residency and the Associate Medical Director of Orange County EMS. He says the emergency room's like a window into humanity. Dr. Christopher Hunter, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Tell me about the kinds of things you see in emergency rooms in summer. How is it different from what you see for the rest of the year?
Sure. You know, there's some things that we see an increased volume of in the summer that have to do with the weather getting warmer and what people do. I think a lot of it also has to do with kids being out of school and also the folks that vacation here when their kids are out of school. But, you know, we see more sports-related injuries because people are outside doing things, some simple stuff, twisted ankles and cuts and monkey bar injuries. But we also unfortunately see some of the more serious kind of injuries that you think about with summertime play, especially when you think about drownings and things along those lines with pool safety. You know, probably the one real true public health message I would say having to do with summertime has to do with swimming and child safety in pools. Even if your child knows how to swim, they still shouldn't be unaccompanied. Someone should be there. You know, again, in the summertime when we see more people in pools, we typically do see an increase in this. And it's one of those things that people don't really think about how dangerous water can be and how quickly it can become dangerous. So, you know, I would say that make sure, especially with your children or someone who doesn't know how to swim, that you're there with them. And if they do know how to swim, that you're always have some sort of adult watching them and you know, keeping contact with them.
Do you see a lot of drowning cases come to the emergency room? Do they make it that far?
A number do. Thankfully, you know, with places that have lifeguards or astute other individuals that can get someone out, you know, we also see a lot of what medically people still term as near drowning, which really is drowning, but the person didn't die. You know, maybe you got them out of the water, they were unconscious. Maybe someone did CPR. Maybe you just got them out in time and they coughed up the water. Those patients do come to the ER, and it's important that they do because there is, you know, a phenomena after the fact, several hours after the fact, where your lungs can become inflamed if you've inhaled too much or aspirated too much water. So it's always important for us to monitor those and make sure that doesn't happen.
They would have to go into the hospital for observation or something?
It depends on how serious and how close the patient was to actual death or how much they aspirated. Normally, we observe for several hours. Some of those patients do go home. Some of them need to get admitted overnight just to make sure.
You're going to see different kinds of accidents and injuries depending on what part of the country you're in.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, if you think about it, you know, some states have massive increases in volume in their emergency departments in the summer just because it's been so cold for so long and people are outside and it's the only time of year people are swimming or people are out, you know, having barbecues. Here in Florida, we don't see quite as wild a swing. But we do see, you know, noticeable trends. Obviously, in the wintertime, we see more flus and viral illnesses and those kind of things that you equate with kids being in school and being in close quarters. And in the summertime, we see less of that, but we end up seeing more of those active sports injuries and traumatic injuries. And then, you know, there's also the really rare but frightening things that we almost exclusively see in summer here that regarding really long stretches of heat. One of them being obviously heat-related illness, but the other, which frequently finds its way into the news once or twice a year, is amoeba meningitis that occurs from very, very warm, fresh water, like Agaria filari.
Do you see many of those cases in the emergency room?
Thankfully, no, because they're exceedingly rare, but they're also exceedingly deadly. In my personal practice, I've only ever cared for two people who were diagnosed with it. I know that recently there are some advantageous treatments that are coming out, and there's, you know, some ideas of perhaps we'll have the ability to treat this in the future. But, you know, technically within the House of Medicine, this is a universally fatal illness. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, probably more rare than being struck by lightning. Well, certainly more rare than being struck by lightning. So it's one of those things that captures the mind of people because it's just so scary. But at the same time, it's still rare. And it usually has to do with very warm water that is contaminated with this amoeba, fresh water, that is somehow getting into the sinuses or near the brain. So usually splashing around in really warm pond or lake water is what this is from.
And some of the cases you hear about are children oftentimes. So it adds to the tragedy and the frightening nature of the illness.
Indeed, yeah. Both the cases I've seen were in pediatrics, you know, early teenage kind of years. The type of age group that is more likely to be splashing around in warm water, I'd say, in some senses. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned that versus the chance of being struck by lightning. Have you ever treated a lightning strike case?
I have seen one. Again, I've only been practicing 9 or 10 years. I'm sure some of my colleagues who've been around longer have certainly seen it. We are in one of the lightning strike capitals of the world here in Central Florida. So I have only seen one, and it was essentially a mild case. The lightning struck near the individual, and the individual was, you know, secondary to it. But we do see it. But again, it's another one of those things I'd list under the exceedingly rare, but very interesting because of how serious it can be. You know, what's interesting about lightning strikes is that the survivability is actually fairly high as long as, you know, based on the situation. So it's interesting. I mean, some people are struck and obviously, unfortunately, you can't save them. But frequently people do survive lightning strike and after the fact usually have very mild injuries, which is kind of shocking when you think of just how powerful they are. But has to do with how amazingly brief that power is. So
I guess the other thing we have in Florida is, aside from being the lightning capital of the world, there's a lot of wildlife that people can come in contact with. Do you encounter more injuries with people tussling with wild animals that inadvertently?
I think nationwide the answer to that question is yes. In emergency rooms here locally, I don't know 100%. You know, it's probably a better question for the Department of Health. Do we have more kind of bites and things? You know, again, people are outside more. If I look back, you know, people stumbling upon snakes and things like that would bring them to the ER is higher in the summer because they're out there. We don't see a ton of wildlife-related injuries. You know, most bites, you know, are still from domesticated animals here that we treat far and away. You know, we do see, again, it's things that capture everyone's attention when a bear or an alligator or something along those lines, something more dramatic, a shark bite out on the coast. But we do see people that come into the ER with more minor, I guess, outdoor-related injuries, a fish hook, you know, stuck in your hand when you're out fishing, or a barb from a catfish, you know, getting stuck in somebody. It's very painful. They come see people who've been stung by stingrays, jellyfish, you know, so the stuff that's less life-threatening, less likely to get on the news, we do see increases in those sort of things just because people are out and about.
What's it like working in an ER in a city where you have such a high tourism rate? Do you have like a hubbub of different languages? Is that sometimes difficult to navigate?
It sometimes is. I mean, it's one of the most interesting things about working in the emergency department here is the tens of millions of visitors that we have. And thankfully, many of them hopefully don't wind up in the ER, but enough of them do. You know, when it comes to language, nowadays, there's such great technology with that when it comes to, you know, essentially video telephonic, you know, communication where you can, you know, pull up something on what looks basically like an iPad. I don't know what the device really is. And call up somebody so they're face to face with the patient and can communicate. And you know, they probably have 100 different languages there. You know, the majority of our non-English speakers are usually still Spanish or Portuguese, you know, so we have a lot of folks that speak those languages. I'd say what's more unique probably to us, particularly in pediatrics, would be the folks that come here from those foundations that bring children who are very ill or families who just want to take their you know, distinctly ill kids to the theme park. So, you know, it's not as rare for us in the children's ER to see people with extraordinarily rare genetic or whatever disorders that happens to be in town for whatever, whether it's a conference for muscular dystrophy or whether it's just a patient with one of those genetic disorders that is names you can barely pronounce. And the parents usually come in with a lot of knowledge saying, you know, here's what it is. You know, here's a sheet. He's one of 10 kids in the world with it. You know, this is what you do. But we do see that. Probably more often than you would in most other places.
So the pediatrics department, though, they'd be primed for it.
I think so, yeah. You know, and then there are other, particularly pediatrics, cases of kids who have, you know, some scary or dangerous diseases or types of cancer that are really scary. And a lot of times their physicians will even tell the parents, you know, where to go, what to do if something happens. So they'll come and you'll speak to people and call them from, you know, faraway places, and the doctors usually know they're coming, right?
What's the weirdest summertime injury or ailment that you've seen in the emergency room?
Oh, you know, I had an individual come in once who had been bit by a snake, a juvenile water moccasin, and the snake was still attached to him. That was interesting.
They're pretty dangerous snakes too, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. It was the bigger ones are less likely to actually inject venom. The smaller juvenile ones can't control it as well. But this was a fairly small one, but it had somehow got its fang hooked in this individual's leg in a manner that the guy couldn't pull it off. He whacked the snake enough times to basically kill it, but it was just hanging off his leg. So he came in with a snake that's, you know, stuck to him. Mm-hmm. That was a relatively interesting kind of summertime thing, having him bring the snake attached to him. So things like that, you know, the emergency department's a window into humanity. So every day, every shift, there's something that always kind of makes your eyes like, wow, look at that. It's hard to think of just one from the summer.
And that interview first aired on Intersection back in July 2017. Up next, music from Zoya Zafar. We're back in a minute.
Hard on the ground, just wanna mean something.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're going to revisit an interview with a young singer-songwriter who's making waves on the Orlando music scene. Zoya Zafar stopped by our studios to perform and talk about her music last February. Zoya Zafar is a young singer-songwriter from Orlando. The Orlando Weekly calls her one of 14 local artists reshaping the Orlando music scene. She joins us now in studio with a song called Go Kiss Your Girl.
The dreams I had of you, all I ever wanted was to hear you say that you don't love me and you never will. I hate the way you look at me, and I hate the way you say my name. And now I know I never knew you at all. I know you never cared about me, so why don't you just let me be? Go kiss your girl. I've given up on figuring you out. How you feeling if you're having doubts? But I bet you don't care, and I'm not caring too. I've decided that we will never be. Not even if we lived in the same city. And now I'm waiting for the day where I have nothing to say. I know you never cared.
You're listening to Intersection, Zoya Zafar performing Go Kiss Your Girl.
It was a very therapeutic song that I wrote during I think it was very cathartic and just like something that I had to get out. I actually wrote it about 3 years ago or so. So it's actually one of the songs that I play a lot that people kind of gravitate towards. Music is something that I really do as a form of therapy in a way. If I'm feeling a certain way or want to get a certain emotion out. So generally my music is kind of sad.
Zafar says she was always shy about singing, even though it was something she loved to do.
I always used to love writing as well. If it wasn't like songs, it was like short stories or poems that I did. And then my uncle was in a band, so I wanted to play guitar. So it was like one of those things where it just seemed like a really cool thing to do. And I originally took it as like a class in like middle school. They like just offered it. It was like something brand new. And I didn't really like it then. I was just like, I didn't like the songs that we were playing, and it was just very boring. And there was also like that learning curve of having to press down hard on the strings. So, but then like later on, like I think like the summer after, I was just like, oh, I still want to play. So I just like learned the songs that I wanted to learn. And so singing and like that kind of just all happened when I was able to play the guitar. Then I immediately wanted to write songs. It just like was very natural to want to do that.
So you've got a demo and an EP that you've produced and put out. I think the EP came out in 2015, is that right? Spaceless Craft?
Yeah, that that was really cool because it was my first time in a studio. And one of my good friends, Matthew Fowler, his manager, owned the studio in Pittsburgh. So I hadn't had like a proper recording. I had a demo out before that I kind of just made in my bedroom. He was really nice and wanted to help me out. And so I flew up to Pittsburgh and we kind of made that EP in like 4 days. So it was a great learning experience, and just like being in that environment was really helpful. And it was really nice to get just to focus on the EP and mm-hmm. just get it done.
Are you a perfectionist, or do you like to just lay things down and that's it, sort of one take?
I would say a little bit of both. I think overall I'm not much of a perfectionist. Like recording gives me anxiety normally because having to get it perfect. Mm-hmm. So I'm just like, I know I'm probably going to mess up or something. But, I mean, it is an important skill to have, like, as a musician. And, like, recording with, like, other musicians and in that environment of, like, a studio makes you more aware of, like, being on time, like on rhythm, working with others. And but yeah, I think I'm learning a lot. I'm trying to become more of a perfectionist because I'm kind of a little bit lazy when it comes to music. And like I like playing live shows because they're not recorded normally.
Now you're working on a full-length album?
Yeah, so I have everything written for it, and it's just a matter of figuring out production and just everything that goes into recording and finding mm-hmm. a place to record and basically all of that.
And over the last few months, you've performed a couple of bigger shows in Orlando with some other artists as well. How have those shows gone?
Those have been great. So the Will's Pub show that I recently played in December was really great lineup. And it's really nice because you can discover new bands that are local to you and work with them as well. And it was a really fun show. I was there the entire night. Yeah, I think overall, just also playing these bigger shows kind of, it's like this learning curve of just like, we were practicing pretty much, practicing more than I ever have practiced, basically. Like, especially when you have someone playing with you, you have to like make sure that like you don't mess up because then they might mess up. It's very collaborative. I was so used to playing solo for such a long time that like we definitely had to practice a lot and making sure that everything, we could work out all the kinks and there wouldn't be any hiccups on stage.
You've been named one of 14 local artists reshaping the Orlando music scene in a recent piece in the Orlando Weekly. I wonder what your thoughts are about the Orlando music scene. Like, what stands out for you about Orlando's music scene right now?
Well, right now I think it's probably better than it has ever been. I think the DIY scene is really great right now, and I think a lot of it's not really competitive in a way. So I feel like most musicians and like even like visual artists and stuff, they're all kind of collaborating in a way. And Orlando has the advantage. I mean, it's not like a gigantic city like New York or LA, but it's not like a small town either. So you have like, it's easy to kind of like have these connections and kind of like get play these bigger bigger venues.
Mm-hmm.
And like there is like an art scene and a music scene. So, and there's really creative people here too. So that aspect of it is great, and I think it makes it a very accessible city for people who want to, like, do things. Like, it's easy kind of to, like, just message, like, another musician and say, like, do you want to do the show together and, like, coordinate that.
Zoe Zafar, thank you so much for joining us and talking about your music and performing.
Thank you for having me.
And here's Zoe Zafar with a song called To You.
Surrounded by nothing, heart on the ground, just wanna mean something. To you, to you, to you. It's a lonely night under dark stars and a dark sky. Surrounded by nothing, heart on the ground, just wanna mean something to you, to you, to you. Just wanna mean something to you, to you.
Zoe Zafar with a song called To You. You can find more of Zafar's music on SoundCloud and Bandcamp and upcoming shows on her Facebook page, Zoe Zafar Music. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The show's executive producer is Catherine Welch. Find us on the NPR One app. You can also check out our previous shows on our website, wmfe.org/intersection, and download the podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.